Good afternoon, and welcome to another episode of We the People Radio. My name is Aaron Ryan.
And I'm Bill Cundiff.
So this week I'm not sick, but Bill is, so we've traded places. We're not happy through the winter if somebody isn't down the drain.
That's right.
Don't really know why that is. So not a lot of announcement-y kind of stuff today. I really wanted to get right to our guest because we watched the documentary last night. Michael Pack is the producer and director of The Last 600 Meters. He's the president of Manifold Productions and an independent film and television company founded in 1977. He has written, directed, and produced numerous award-winning nationally broadcast documentaries, as well as corporate and educational films. He's also the president of Palladium Pictures. So I looked at the list of all of these. There's so much more information. I hope you will go to the website. Today is November 30th, 2025, post-Thanksgiving. Hope you all had a good time with your family, provided you got to go. It seemed like this was the year that everybody's plans changed, though, so I don't know.
Oh, yeah, the airlines were a mess.
Everybody had plans, and somebody got sick, and that was the end of that. It just seemed like I heard that from a lot of people. But so you had a little extra time to watch things, and you've got one day left before you go back to work. I would encourage you, get on, we found it on PBS Documentary, and I'm sure Michael can give us more places. But Manifold Productions and Palladium Pictures, both of those sites were super interesting. And the one thing I didn't want to miss out was the quote from General James Mattis, who was, Mad Dog Mattis, everybody knows who he is. And he said about this this documentary, "The Last 600 Meters reveals the infantry's world as has seldom been seen by those who have not experienced it. This film, uncaptured by politics or ideology, reveals the most bruising ethical environment on earth and the character of the young men that our nation sends in harm's way. It's infantry." And honestly, to say that it is absent of politics and all that sort of thing, which is what our show is about quite a bit, really and truly there was no judgment, no interjecting there, and you really couldn't figure out, Michael, if you thought that the war effort was a good idea or a bad idea, which is really quite a testament to your film skills.
Well, thank you, Aaron. Well, that is how we intended it. I think that's really high praise from General Mattis, who was really the guiding force in the first Battle of Fallujah. So, and he knows of what he speaks, so I'm flattered by that. And, yeah, your listeners can watch the film on Amazon. They can just, search for The Last 600 Meters. I think it's $2.99, so it's, I think, even a good deal by Amazon standards. And then, as you say, I've done 15 or so films that have been on nationally broadcast, mostly on PBS, and they can all be findable. They're all findable through our websites, Manifold Productions and Palladium Pictures. And the very last one, before this one, was one about Clarence Thomas.
Yeah.
Some of your listeners might have seen Created Equal, Clarence Thomas in His Own Words, and that is also on Amazon, actually.
That was amazing. There's one on the birth of nuclear power, and
yes.
Alexander Hamilton, George Washington, Rodney King. I saw that. I didn't see the documentary, but I saw that on your list, and I thought, well, that must have been interesting to unravel.
It was. I think it's, we made it about 10 years after the incident occurred, and we interviewed Rodney King, which you cannot do anymore since he's passed away, and several of the police that were charged. And I think it's actually a model in a way for all the post George Floyd and George Floyd himself, all these controversies and riots where they're vastly misunderstood. In that case, there was this brutal beating of Rodney King with first tasers and then batons, and the cops felt, he was on PCP, he kept attacking them. They felt happy they didn't have to use lethal force, but the beating was videotaped. It looked brutal to everybody. It was brutal. And in the end, those policemen were charged with excessive force, and the idea was maybe in the batoning of Rodney King, maybe the last five or six baton strokes were excessive. But no one denied that some of them were not, and they were following police procedure. But one thing that Rodney King incident was not, it was not racist. These cops were not racist. You know, there was one that's Hispanic, one of them had adopted black children. I mean, they just were not racist. It wasn't racially motivated. Maybe it was excessive force, that's debatable. But it became an icon in the history of race in America. And why? I mean, it's just one of those things where it's a total media creation. I mean, in the sense that it's a symbol of racism. So that tends to happen. I mean, it's the same with George Floyd. Was he killed by that police officer Chauvin, or was he not? Yes or no, hard to tell. It doesn't seem to me to be racially motivated by Derek Chauvin. I mean, so a lot of these things are a symbol of racism when they're provably not based on race. And the Rodney King was the first of those. And you can see it happen in the course of that film, you know, how it goes from the first videotaping to then it becomes a cause celeb and who picks it up and how it's used politically. So I think a great film. It's an hour, and you can watch it and find it on our website.
Yeah, and then, I mean, think about what that was the spark of so much to come after that.
It was.
I bet that's just absolutely frustrating, especially when you're trying to document all these things, and as you're peeling all this apart, you look and you go, wow. All of this was just misconstrued.
Indeed. You know, that is certainly a problem. And, you know, it's picked up for political reasons and you know, it's completely changed. I think those of us, and I include both of us, Aaron, in the media, you know, it's the media. We have a lot of responsibility to bear.
Oh, yeah. Well, nobody wants to put something out there that isn't going to, but it goes with interviews, it goes with, you see it all the time. I mean, even you look at, in our members of Congress, there are 535 people on the Hill, and what do we hear from? Eight of them?
That is very true.
You know, we hear from eight people who say really incendiary things, and they seem to grab all the headlines. They're not necessarily the smartest. They're not necessarily doing the most work. But they're loud, and they get everybody wound up. And so, well, let's definitely put them in front.
That's quite true. I mean, it's a real distortion in our political life, no doubt. And that's why I'm flattered that General Mattis saw that we did not put ideology or politics in the last 600 meters. I mean, I have my own views about the war in Iraq and Afghanistan, but that one we tried to tell the story, as you know, having watched it, from the point of view of the people who fought there, from corporals and sergeants up to the one-star generals that were in the field actually fighting.
Mm-hmm.
And as you know, it's called the last 600 meters because a Special Forces sniper says, "I don't make foreign policy, I deliver the last 600 meters of it." Meaning what he could see through the sniper scope. And that's what we tried to stay true to, what the battle looked like from the ground truth. And we tried to tell it as a battle story, as if it were any battle, Gettysburg, Iwo Jima, any famous battle. And I think that people should try to understand the battles for what they are, an important part of American history, and not see it clouded by the ideology. And even though it took us many years to make, this might be the right time for it to be out there.
Well, I thought that, I mean, and you didn't, it was also a really good balance between things that were really gory. I mean, the contractors that were hung from the scaffolding and dragged through the street. So you included that. But then there were also the conversations between the guys and them singing, like, the Mickey Mouse Club and, you know, stuff like that. It was, you weren't just immersed in this punch-you-in-the-face war thing.
We tried to give a feeling for what it's like. I mean, I've never been in battle, but I tried to give a feeling for what those mainly men, but one woman, you know, told us really about what it was like. And as you say, it's the story of the first Battle of Fallujah, the Joff, and the second Battle of Fallujah, the biggest battles America has fought since Vietnam, which is why I think it's worth understanding the story. As you say, the first Battle of Fallujah began when those four Blackwater contractors traveled through Fallujah, were killed, burned, right through the streets of Fallujah. Two of them hung from a bridge while insurgents danced beneath their
corpses. Oh, yeah.
A gruesome image. Yeah, and you can see it. And a gruesome image that really caused the whole thing to start. And even though General Mattis recommended only pursuing those that were guilty, there was a desire to clear out the whole city of Fallujah. And that began this sort of six-month process that the film depicts. And we did try to give you a feel for what it's like, you know, in between the battles, you know, the difficulty, but not go soft on the horrors of war. You know, we did not try to make it, it's not really a rah-rah kind of military film. These people, you can see the courage and valor of these young people that are there in the, you know, doing the fighting, but you can also see the horrors of war, as you said, and we did not want to go light on that.
No, but you also didn't, you didn't include all of the political. You did, but you didn't. You know, the it was very clear that there were things that we, based on the on the ground assessment, things that we should have done that we didn't do. And it's like anyone who was alive during that time period was this 2004. Anybody who was an adult during that time, kind of paying attention even tangentially, was like, oh yeah, and then it got so much worse. So that was kind of hard to know, I guess.
Well, we tried to give it what it was like when these sort of changing political winds, you know, hit the battlefield, what it was like, how the troops on the ground responded. So, yeah, so that just to start the recap the beginning of the story. So then they go into the, because of this horrific image, the military is ordered to clear the city. But then the Marines clearing the city, you know, Al Jazeera and others are made make that look also barbaric and vicious. And because of that, the Marines are told to halt halfway through. A horrible position to be in. You know, you're standing there in a position with, you know, a fixed position where insurgents can know where you are. But then they negotiate with the insurgents, and they're told to pull out and hand the city over to, essentially to the insurgents, the Fallujah Brigade, to run as they see fit without any military oversight, in which case Fallujah turns into this hellscape. You know, it's an arms depot. It's a place for insurgents to rest between from city to city. There are torture chambers, and then finally there are beheadings there. And the image of the beheadings causes the second battle of Fallujah 6 months later. But you can see the Marines in and out and in and out. You know, what it's like to be told first you're going to take Fallujah, and then you're going to pull out. And as one of these Marines says, yeah, so in the first Battle of Fallujah, first we're fighting them, and then suddenly we're negotiating with the exact same people. But as he says, what's a few RPGs between friends?
Yeah, right. That was a good line.
A very, you know, cynical, bitter comment by an unhappy Marine. But they do what, you know, they're there to follow orders, you know, and you know, in light of the present controversy, these were clearly legal orders, and they didn't hesitate to follow them. So that's right. It was what it was like on the ground. But, you know, my own view, given that we're now talking and I don't have to not inject my own view in, is that, you know, it's very hard to make these calls. You know, it's hard to fight a counterinsurgency. You know, the political forces in the State Department and senior military in Washington were worried about losing the hearts and minds of the Iraqis. You know, you can't have a, you know, so that it's a delicate balance, and clearly we did make mistakes. But the film is meant to see what it's like from the ground, and not necessarily pass judgment on those people making those decisions. You know, clearly in retrospect, a lot of them were wrong, but that is not in the film. I should also say that we were lucky to be able to conduct the interviews for the film 3 years after the battle of 2007. Yeah. So the people we interviewed, you know, their memories were fresh. They look like they do in the footage. And that's how we proceeded. We found the footage of the key moments of the battles. and they found the people in them, so they could talk about the footage that they were in. And they tell the story, as you said, straight to camera, looking right at the audience without any commentary or narration. And they tell what it was like to fight these battles on the ground. So, you know, that's why there is no politics in it. And I think but you do get a sense for the heroism and valor of these young, mainly Marines, not only Marines, but mainly Marine battles. And I think that now, we first did a version of the film in 2008, and PBS initially felt it was too pro-military, which I actually don't think it is, for the reasons you already said, Aaron. I mean, we have all the horrors of war in there, too. But it did take them 17 years to reverse it, and I'm happy that now they have finally broadcast it, and they're distributing it to Amazon and elsewhere. They gave us a great time slot, prime time, the day before Veterans Day, the Marine Corps birthday, 250th birthday. So I think now, 21 years after the battle, we can look back and see what it was like to fight and the heroism of these young people without being clouded by the ideology. It's much easier to do it now, maybe, than it was when we initially finished the film in 2008.
Oh, yeah. I wondered how much pressure there was on that. We have to take a really quick break. We're going to come back. Our guest is Michael Pack. He is the director of The Last 600 Meters. And if you have not seen that, you really owe it to yourself, even though it seems like an odd time of year to watch a war documentary, and you've probably seen many. This will stand out for you. It's different than most of what is out there. And I think you'll learn a lot, too. Anyway, you can find all that information at wethepeopleradio.us for today, November 30th, 2025. We'll be right back. And I guess I didn't do the other part. And we're back. Bill was fermenting questions over there. They're ready for prime time.
Yeah. I had a thought, Michael. You know, the interviews in the film, I think, were very impactful. I mean, to get it right from the people that were there. How difficult was that to sit down with these folks and relive all that? I mean, it was obviously a very horror-filled battle, and you could see it when you were interviewing them that some of them really struggled with talking about it. How hard was it to interview these folks?
It was. That's a lot of the work in this kind of a film, is sort of winning these people's trust.
Mm-hmm.
I think it is hard for them to talk about. I mean, you have to spend a lot of time with them before they trust you. And I remember when I went and had dinner with this guy and his wife, and all dinner long, he just wouldn't discuss anything. And then finally, when his wife left, he was willing to talk about it. And one of them, like, actually have trouble talking about it to their own families. I've seen that as a bit of a trend. And so now it's been 17 years since I interviewed them, and we had this screening in Washington recently where I invited a lot of veterans, and they came, they came up for the Q&A, and a lot of them also told me that they want to show it to their families, because even now they can't quite talk about it, and it's sort of easier to show the film than talk about it. So it was hard, and in the end, I think we did get very frank and open discussions from all of them, and so I really appreciate them. It's a gift when people entrust you with their story, especially, as you just said, these difficult emotional stories. Mm-hmm. So It was hard in the beginning, and especially because it was 3 years after the battle. I mean, now they're probably used to telling a kind of expurgated version of it to people who ask. But at the time, the memories were even fresher, and it was all the harder. So, yeah, it was challenging, you know, and it is a gift that I honored. I also said at the time, I promised them that I would get the thing nationally broadcast. It only took me 17 years, but at least I kept my promise.
You did. So, God. Well, what you're spot on with them not wanting to talk about it. We have a family member who was in Beirut right after the whole Beirut barracks bombing. And I don't know what brought the whole thing up, but we were sitting around the pool one day talking about different experiences that he had in Beirut. And he got up to get a drink or something, and his wife was sitting there, and she said, "I've never heard any of this. He's never talked about it," which was amazing.
It's hard. I mean, we had one of the most gratifying things that happened in this meeting when this film was broadcast is that, you know, there's a part of the film where we talked to a bunch of special forces officers and NCOs about their effort to track down high value targets in the middle of the battle of Najaf. And one of them talks briefly about one who was killed in one of these operations. And we heard from his sister, who said, you know, I really never really understood what he was doing, especially because it's a special forces operation. Mm-hmm. I didn't ever understand it. I didn't understand the context. I've been sort of wondering for 17 years, you know, thank you for explaining it, you know. And, you know, it's something that never even occurred to me. And luckily, the person mainly talked about it okay, sending her a little more of his interview to get her that focused on her brother in particular. But that's sort of an example where, you know, you're at a loss and you wonder. And, you know, so I think that's right. It's a difficult process. And I hope that the being in the film and talking in the film is part of a healing process and not just a difficulty. But, and, you know, we never push people to tell something they don't want to tell. I mean, right now, we have another military-themed film that we're working on. We are doing a series of short documentaries with the Wall Street Journal opinion section. We've done two already. Those are totally free outside the Wall Street Journal paywall at wsj.com/opiniondocs or findable through our palladiumpictures.com website. We have two that are completed, but one of the three in development is on the withdrawal from Afghanistan. And those Marines that were at Abbey Gate and the other gates during the very chaotic withdrawal also have a hugely difficult time talking, and a large number have said they just don't want to relive it. And I'm totally sympathetic, and we only try to interview those who feel comfortable, for whom it is therapeutic, and want to get the word out to others. So, yeah, it's always a difficult and challenging process.
Yeah, I think the only way you're going to get the real story and the truth is by interviewing these fellows that were there and lived it, you know, and that's just got to be incredibly difficult to interview and to talk about when you see what they went through.
Indeed, it is difficult. And, you know, these battles are complicated. I mean, in the case of the last 600 meters, these three battles, Fallujah, Najaf, the second battle, Fallujah, they're vast. Huge number of people are involved. So, you can't just tell the story from the point of view of the grunts, of the corporals and the sergeants that are clearing houses. You've got to also tell it from the point of view of majors and captains and, you know, colonels. You know, so it's a complex thing. And in the end, you know, you're only giving a piece of it. You hope you give enough pieces to give a feeling for the battle. But they're vast, huge, you know, many thousands of people over a big area. And that's actually true for even Civil War battles. You know, you see reenactors, a few dozen reenact it, something that took thousands. And it's very hard to give the full sense of what it's like and the scale and the level of challenges and decisions at all the layers of the command. So,
well, the part that really struck me, my brother was Special Forces during the 80s, and he when he came back I mean, everyone says the same thing. He was really different when he came back, which we were I was just out of college, so, you know, what did we know? But as you get older, you realize, okay, that was the change. That was just a change. He went through things that we didn't know anything about. But the thing that stuck with all of us that meant nothing at the time, because it was the 80s, right? We didn't have computers. We didn't have all these movies about this stuff. We knew nothing about the Middle East. We knew nothing about the Middle East, honestly. And when he came back, I remember him having a really kind of aggressive conversation with my mom, who really believed everybody was basically nice and that people didn't need to carry guns and that police were going to save you from everything. And she grew up in a world like that, which was a great world for her. But my brother said, "You have no idea how little these people value human life. It is a totally different mindset, and we will fight." He said, "We will fight them over there forever, or they will come here. And if they come here, they will go through us like a hot knife through butter, because we are wholly unprepared with the barbarity." And I mean, that was 30 years ago, 40 years ago. I don't forget how old I am now. 40 years ago, and I watched that movie, and I thought, "There you go."
Well, too, you also have to realize these were kids. I mean, a lot of these that were fighting over there were 18 to 20, 22. I mean, young. Haven't really experienced a whole lot.
No, but the things that the enemy was willing to do.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. But this is something that they have to be saddled with now the rest of their lives, the experiences that they went through. And
indeed, it's a lot to ask them to bear, but you are quite right, Aaron, about the barbarity of it. I mean, that's why, I mean, in the sort of director's cut, we show a little more of this beheading that motivated the Second Battle of Fallujah, because otherwise the Marines do look barbaric if you don't understand the barbarity of the enemy they fought. And that particular thing, the beheading, you know, these beheadings were not different. Those were videos that were not hard to find. You know, the insurgents put it, this is Al-Qaeda in this case, Al-Qaeda in Iraq, Zarqawi, they put it on their website. For them, it was a recruiting video. They wanted the world to see it. And these beheadings are not just, you know, kind of like a ritual murder, you know, where you put a gun to someone's forehead and shoot. You know, it takes a long time to behead someone. And the actual videos on the website are long. And then, you know, they hold up the head, the beheaded head, you know, in their hands, hanging from, with the, you know, by the hair, in front of the camera, with the blood dripping. And it's a sign, you know, it's a very barbaric ritual of a kind, you know, sending a very clear signal about what they're willing to do. I mean, they do it on purpose. They broadcast to the world on purpose. And we have a very expurgated version in the PBS and the Amazon version. But I'm glad that it's at least hinted at, because
the point got through. It was actually really well done. It wasn't like, "Oh, we need to turn this off." Well, I wouldn't have done that anyway, but it, even for, like, because I was thinking about, my mom's gone now, but I thought, I wonder if my mom watched this, if she would have understood what he was telling her all those years ago.
Yeah. Well, that's, and then, to your point, so then the Second Battle of Fallujah happens, and this time, to avoid the negative publicity from the first battle, the Marines announce they're clearing when they're going to clear the city. And so they encourage all civilians to leave, and maybe 80% left, as did the leadership of the insurgency. You know, they're not idiots. They all went to nearby Ramadi. So the people remaining in Fallujah, some civilians, and then the insurgents were actually ready to die. Their only goal was to kill as many Marines as they could before they would die and, you know, go to heaven and get their 73 virgins or whatever it is. So they were taking amphetamines, whatever they could, and to kill as many. And as one of the sergeants says, Sergeant Piano says, you know, they're not afraid to die. How do you fight them? They're not only not afraid to die, they're willing to die. So it's a particularly brutal battle for that reason. And I think it is important, you know, to understand that, you know. And then to your point about the being young, and then, you know, Sergeant Piana, these sergeants and corporals, they're 18, 19, 20, 21. They're right.
He got shot in the head. That whole thing, was amazing, because when the other guy, whose name eludes me because it wasn't Piano, perfect name, when he said, you know, I just saw the Kevlar, it's like, oh my God. Poof. And then all of a sudden, the guy, I actually rolled it back and I looked at the name below and I'm like, wait, that's the guy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He shot in the head and he's lucky to survive. As he said, too, you know, he felt guilty because, as he said, the Marines, you're not supposed to be shot. You know, he feels he left his Marines, let his Marines down. A very Marine sergeant kind of attitude. But yeah, I mean, before that, you know, they're kicking down doors. They kick down a door in Fallujah. Who's on the other side? Is it a civilian you have to help and give order to? Is it an insurgent who's going to pull a gun and kill you? And you have to decide instantaneously and not make mistakes. And it's really a lot to ask of 18, 19, 20-year-old, you know, young people.
Well, and they were that on-the-ground perspective in all of those battles was like the policy was kind of turning on a dime in some cases. You know,
right.
Okay, we're
going to
go take the whole city. Wait, no, we're going to wait, and we're going to be friends with everyone. Oh, wait.
Yeah. After you've already started.
Yeah,
you know.
Right.
Yeah, after they started. That's right. It's really, yeah, you can see their frustration. Absolutely.
Yeah. That came off, I thought that was all those things. That never makes most of the things we see about these sorts of issues, right? Whether it's a battle or something where you have all this, everyone knows about it. You've seen it on the news, and we watched it for years. But you don't see this level, and that I thought was the most important part. And for the people who were there, I thought it was really a very honorable thing to do for them.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, you don't really see what it's like on the ground. I mean, a lot of the attention for the Iraqi veterans has been on PTSD and the difficulties coming home, and then horrors like, you know, Abu Ghraib, and all those things are legitimate subjects, but we don't see what they actually was like in the battle. And I think they want us to see that and understand it. And I am glad to be able to do that. And, you know, I hope... You know, so my family is not a military family, unlike both of you. And so we didn't know that many people in the military. So for us, it was very eye-opening to meet and see these people. And I think there's a lot of America, unfortunately, like that. And maybe my film could help close that gap.
Tell me this. I was curious why... Maybe we should take an early... Let's take our break just a little bit early so I don't interrupt. But I was curious why you chose, I mean, of all the different things that we've been involved in as a country overseas, if you were going to do something about a piece of a war, I'm super curious why you chose that and how that came about. I thought about it the whole film. I'm like, the quote, the you know, we don't make foreign policy, we just deliver the last 600 meters. And I thought, if I would have heard that, I would have said, I got to go make a movie about that. But I was curious, how you got the idea. We'll be right back. You're listening to We the People. You can find us at wethepeopleradio.us.
Loaded guns in your face, and you'll have to do-
So you could have been listening to that song, and you said to yourself, I need to make a movie.
That's true.
Or maybe not.
It's true.
Seriously, what made you think of it?
Well, I had a grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting to develop a movie about the war in Iraq. It was ongoing at the time,
uh-huh.
So I began the process in 2005 or so. And initially, we were going to do a movie about technology and warfare, which, as you may recall, those listeners old enough to recall might recall, that the beginning of the war in Afghanistan was very focused on technology. You know, a bunch of special forces people had allied with the Northern Alliance, were able to take down the Taliban with the help of extremely, for the time, sophisticated air support. And so they were on horseback, and high-technology weapons were sent with guided missiles to blow out the Taliban, and it all looked like it was going to be a high-tech war. But then, in researching it and running across the veterans of these battles, I saw that there really was another side to it that really, although technology was important, it really depended a lot on the very traditional valor and courage of these young people, and I wanted to tell their story. It's not that far from what you said, Aaron, before the break. You know, you hear somebody say, I don't do foreign policy, I delivered less than 600 meters of it, and it's logical to want to make a film. And that's how we felt, too. I met these guys, and I saw their stories weren't being told, and I wanted to capture it. And I wanted to capture it before it faded. So it took a couple of years, but I'm glad that we did. And I think now it's a historic document. I mean, I completed most of the work on it 17 years ago. I think it's still current. I think it'll be current 10 years from now when people look back on these wars, whatever they think about them then, to get a sense of what it was like to fight them. And I do feel that we will be involved also in this kind of counterinsurgency. The focus today is very much on possible war with China and avoiding war with China. And that's really the appropriate focus. And that would be a very different kind of war. But in the meantime, we are likely to be fighting these kind of insurgencies and counterinsurgencies, like Israel is doing in Gaza, like the urban warfare in Ukraine, or like, you know, maybe we'll be fighting a war in Venezuela. Who knows? But, you know, in the midst of playing out the larger states with China, these smaller things are smaller and not so small wars are likely to erupt, and they will have some of the same qualities as the last war we fought, and they'll be different, and it's important to know the differences, but it's important to understand the history too.
Yeah, the cultural gap was, I mean, it is stark, and it's something that I think the things on the college campuses and all of that, everybody's trying to erase that. Oh, we're all just the same. You know, they believe one thing, we believe another thing. But I have known ever since my brother went to the Middle East in the mid-80s that culturally we are not the same. We are not the same. We do not value the same things. And we do not see life in the same way. We just don't.
It's important to understand that. It's very American to think everybody else is like an American. And clearly, you know, the urge to, as people mockingly say, turn Afghanistan or Iraq into a Jeffersonian democracy, which is not quite what we were trying to do, but it was there, it was a sort of naive thing. They're very different cultures and forces at work in the Middle East. And your brother was quite right about that. So, yeah, I think the gap is very big. I live in the Washington, D.C. area. You know, just recently, you know, these two National Guardsmen were shot by an Afghan refugee, you know, and it raises that question of that cultural gap.
Oh, yeah, big time. Well, it just is one of those things that we ignore that at our peril. Truly, it's not at their peril. It's to their advantage that we. But you know, I always kind of laugh. It's always about kids and dogs, right? If it doesn't work with children and dogs, it's not going to work on anything else. And if you treat your dogs like people, you know, and if you treat your kids like grown-ups, it never works out. You have to look at really what you're working with. I didn't want to get out of here, although we have like 10 minutes left, which seems like a lot, but it just goes really fast. The the thing that your publicist sent to us was your kind of commentary on the six Democrats who are urging military members to refuse illegal orders. And after making this film, you had thoughts.
Well, yeah, I mean, as we were saying earlier, a lot of these Marines did not want to follow the orders they were given, and they thought the orders were going to result in the death of lots of Marines, and they were largely right, but they did follow the orders, and that is sort of essential to the military. Clearly, they're not responsible for doing something, you know, manifestly illegal, and I think that rule is surely meant to apply for, like, a captain or a lieutenant telling a sergeant or corporal to shoot, like, a unarmed prisoner, and for which they should refuse. But it's not clear what they were aiming at these six or however many it is that are suggesting made that video. And the video seems to imply that they can think about what's constitutional and not, and what the president is deciding is or isn't right. And there's a mechanism for that. You know, there's the Supreme Court. You know, there are other courts. You know, there's the Congress. And it does, I think, vastly undercut morale. I mean, I hear them say, all they're saying is, you don't have to, what every soldier knows anyway, that you don't have to follow legal orders. But it sometimes strikes me, as I say, I live in Chevy Chase, a sort of affluent suburb of Washington, D.C., and during COVID, there were a lot of those signs. You know, I believe in science, love is love, so all these things that are essentially tautologies, but that imply something. When they say, I believe in science, they meant, I'm going to follow whatever Dr. Fauci says, which is a fine thing to want to do, but it's not just the tautology that you wrote. And when these people say you don't have to follow legal orders in the tone that they did, they're sort of implying that you should question the orders of this president, in particular, in his, blowing up these boats and in other things and other kind of drug interdiction orders. But I think that's really deeply concerning. I think it's destabilizing to the way the military functions.
Yeah. And I do think that the timing of this, you know, it's interesting. It took all this time for this to come out, but the timing was really excellent because it does make it very, very clear that if everybody was running around deciding whether or not they thought, well, maybe I should do it, maybe I won't do it, it's extremely clear when you watch your documentary that's not how it works.
Even if they're right, and most of the time these guys are right, you know, it is not how it works. The president is elected by the people. He's the commander in chief. That's an important cornerstone of American democracy and of the way the republic is supposed to work. So that's right. You can see it in the film, and these people understand it. You know, they do. You know, so they may not always like it, but they understand it and they have bought into it. And to erode that, I mean, it's putting them in an untenable position, and a really worse and more difficult position.
Yeah, and it's all wrapped up in honor for me. That whole idea that you should question everything and go make your own decisions while everybody else is counting on you to do the part that you have agreed to play, but at your whim, you could change your mind. Well, nobody's got anybody's back in a scenario like that.
You know, that is very true.
I think about them going through that big cemetery. What is it? Najaf.
Yeah.
I looked it up, and everybody said it differently, and I was like, forget it, whatever it is.
Yeah, everybody does say it differently.
Yeah, I was like, I don't know how you really say it.
That's the way the Marines say it. I have a feeling that's not the way the natives of Najaf say it. Najaf, some of them say. Well, that's right.
Could you imagine going through there, and then everybody's making their own decision? Well, I don't know if this order's a good one or not. I think I might want to rethink that.
Right.
Good God,
right.
they all get killed.
One half thinks one, and one half thinks the other, and they're sitting there talking about it. And the longer they're talking about it, you know, the more they're a target. You know, so that's right. It adds another level of confusion, and it was confusing enough.
Yeah,
it is confusing enough in war. they have enough things to sort out of extremely difficult and even ethical nature. So,
well, most like war movies, right? When we, you know, most of us have grown up watching war movies, and most of that is, you know, the general says go, everybody bunches together, everybody gets their stuff together, and then off we go, you know, and it all seems very cut and dried, for the most part, and this really was a window into how sometimes, even in the heat of the moment, things are kind of flexible.
That's right. It's never as clean as it looks in a war movie, and we try to put all that stuff back, because this is reality. That's right. It's not as clean, as simple, or straightforward as it looks.
Yeah, I think it's interesting too, because a lot of times when they say, you know, this is a look, you know, like behind the curtain of some battle or whatever, and it's really just kind of a gory depiction of the horror on the ground, which is all true, but it's not really that thought provoking. It's emotionally jarring, which has its own value too. But this was a little of both. You walked away and you were like, oh. I just don't think anybody, even the people who were there, I think would have a lot of value. Do you get a lot of contact from folks who were in these different battles?
Yeah, and I think it does. I mean, for a lot of them it does. For some of them it adds context, and for others of them, you know, they just want those stories to be out. I mean, these are the biggest battles, and the Jaffe in particular, which, as you say, you know, it's in the south against the Mahdi militia Shiite insurgents, unlike Fallujah in the north. And it's largely forgotten. It's a huge battle, you know. At least the word, people have heard the word Fallujah.
Right.
I don't think they could say anything about what happened there. But Najaf sort of lost. And, yeah, I think it puts it in a context, as I say, like the sister of the guy who fought there. I mean, it was eye-opening for her. And, yeah, I think it's helpful to them. And I agree with you completely, Aaron, that you can't just tell what it's like on the ground. From the vantage point of sort of the grunt, it's always about the guy to the left of them, the guy to the right of them, and their buddies. And in that sense, all battles are the same, you know, from Roman times to today. So you need to put that in the context of why they're fighting and what the strategy is and what the intention is and what the other side is thinking, where there's no, you know, differentiation. You can't understand this battle in particular. So I'm glad that you appreciate that range that we really aimed for.
Yeah, I thought you guys, it was really funny because I found myself, I'd read something on your website. I wanted to find it. There was a quote somewhere on one of your sites that spoke about how you wanted to tell an honest story and leave the politics out. And I thought, oh, nobody leaves the politics out. Oh, this guy's going to secretly have it in there somewhere. I kept watching. I was like, oh, you really didn't. Somehow you actually really didn't.
We didn't in that one. Now, it is true that I myself am politically conservative, but I try to keep my politics out. But I feel strongly that documentaries are well suited to have people from all political points of view representing them, and the documentaries are dominated by people from the left. So one thing that we are trying to do is train other people who are right of center, or at least non-woke. And we have an incubator where we give people a grant to make a short film, and we oversee it and executive produce it and help them make it better and then distribute it. So any of your listeners can apply. It's open for the third round. We had two earlier years of this. If they go to the Palladium Pictures website and the incubator, they could hit the Apply Now button and apply, or encourage somebody they know. I mean, you have to have made a few little films and be able to make another film. So it's not right out of film school, but someone in sort of been out of film school 5 or 6, 7 years, you know, and has a passion project.
Like my engineer Alex Barker's in there making the touchdown arms in the other room. He's like me.
Like him, exactly. He should go there right away.
He should.
Of course, he has to finish the work on your show, Aaron. But we can't
lose him because he's the only one who ever gets the music right, so it's pretty great.
Well, that is important.
That is important because that's what breaks up the talking. Michael, we have to run off. And we're sorry we have to run off. We'd love to have you on again to promote other projects. I think it's nice having a long form and being able to do that. Our guest has been Michael Pack. We really appreciate you coming on. I want to hear about all your family being involved, too. I had so many questions about that, and I kind of ran out of time. So you can find all his work and everything at the site at
wethepeopleradio.us.
What is it good for? Absolutely. Say it again.